I think we're ready to do the finals session. Actually, it turns out our TA is more on top of things than I even appreciated. I just got a message that he wrote email to one of the students while class was in session that he finally figured out, or he finally managed to get a Java 8 system up, and he's now has access to it. So he was very proactive in terms of realizing that Java 8 was important to a number of folks, and we wouldn't want to ask you to go backwards for no reason at all. So if you had problems with it, certainly ask him to regrade one if he didn't realize it was the Java 8 problem that caused you the difficulty. I think he's on top of it enough that he'll do grading for 2 with 8 if necessary. And I think what 8 is backwards compatible, so programs written in 7 and beyond are all acceptable. Is that correct? That's normally the way it goes, so let's hope so. But anyway, he did a real nice job in terms of reacting quickly, and I think he did a nice job on the grading sheet, too, in terms of detailing what it is that he determined. So what we want to do now is, let's go back, is that I was showing you some examples of how these AST building goes, and I think what I'm going to do is have a composite example that really helps show you the almost miraculous nature of having the parser determine on its own, by its own analysis, when a production is important. Because that's the key to building the AST reliably and without a lot of effort on your part. So what we're going to do now is, let's look at a program, a CSX Lite program, of course, and actually see how the tree is built. And it's going to be built really in, as I alluded to, sort of a bottom-up form. And when I talk about parsing in more detail, we'll understand a bit why. But in this case, all that you see and all the parsers see is this, with those productions on the side that I showed you earlier. And it's going to go ahead and scratch his head. If any of you are old enough to remember Johnny Carson, he'd have this comic routine. He had Carnap. Remember, Carnap would always guess a particular result that would be funny from just intuiting what was going on. So it's almost like this, almost like somebody guessing, but always guessing right. Now, let me tell you, it's not guessing, it's analysis. But what happens is, seeing here, I, for example, I have two identifiers. And those two identifiers, looking at the grammar, will not be treated identically. But they will be treated similarly in some contexts. So what's going to happen is, when we see identifiers A and B, for example, in one case, it'll be parsed as an identifier or a name. In the other case, it'll be parsed as an expression. And it'll be the parser that decides from context whether or not, for example, there's an assignment on the left or right of that particular symbol, how it's to be processed. So what's going to happen is the parser is going to go along and it's going to start calling the scanner. It'll say, give me a left brace. It'll say, okay, nothing yet. It'll see an A. And it'll say, hey, wait a minute. I know a production that can be applied when this A, which is an identifier, and it's this one. It's going to say this identifier, remember in capitals, it's a terminal. In lowercase, it's the representation of an identifier as an AST node. And it's going to say, hey, I know what I need to do. I need to build a name node. So it's going to go ahead and do the calling, which puts this whole thing together. It says, I'm a name node. I have two children. The left is an ident node named A. The null expression node normally has nothing in it except the fact that it's that node. And it builds that little structure. And then it just holds on to it, because it doesn't need to use it quite yet. And it's decided, so it's doing some bookkeeping. It's got a treasure trove somewhere and saying, sometime I may need this guy, but not quite yet. So it's going to put that aside. How it does it is not obvious, but it works. And because it works, we don't have to worry about it. So the next thing it does is see a B. So going back, it says, it saw an A, created a little subtree, saw a B, say, hey, it's time for me to create another subtree. This is a very similar structure. It's a name node. The ident is a B. And again, the null expert node, because I had the option for an array in the full language, but that'll never be used here. So it's always null. And it holds on to that. So floating off in the void somewhere is a pointer to the A subtree and the B subtree, just waiting for the appropriate time to be united into a bigger tree. When's it going to do it? It decides that through the parsing technique. So it goes ahead and says, hey, B is different than A in that it is in an expression context, and there's a rule that says an expression can be an identifier. What do I do in that case? I simply carry the subtree forward, so the B subtree is what I use for the expression on the right-hand side of the assignment. Now it says, wait a minute, I've seen a left-hand side, I've seen an assignment, I've seen a right-hand side expression. Excuse me. So that is just what I need to build an assignment. So it says, hey, it's time to do an assignment. So it takes an assignment, it wires in the left-hand side that has already been built and just sitting on it for a while. It wires in the right-hand side, which is also an identifier on the right-hand side, and it's got this fairly complex tree as the representation of an assignment. It's got a left-hand side, a right-hand side. It knows that the identifiers are A and B. Eventually, it'll be able to look it up in the symbol table and check types, or do code generation, all kinds of powerful things. Now, here's that business about statements. It says, let's go back here. So it's up to the semicolon. And after the semicolon, it could have had more statements. But it notices, hey, between the semicolon and the right brace, I could have had statements, but I didn't. When I see the right brace, that's a way of saying no more statements, because the right brace says no more program. So it's figured that out somehow, that after seeing a semicolon, if you see a right brace, that means no more statements. So it says, okay, I've got to do something when I have no more statements. There's a production, statements goes to lambda, and what I do is create a little AST node just to remind myself that I had the option of statements, but I chose not to use it. So that's the null statements node. And now that it's got a statements and a statement, it can say, hey, I've got two subtrees. One is null and the other is this subtree corresponding to an assignment statement. And I can wire those together and the result will be a statements node. And here she is. So now it's gotten bigger still. I've got this big subtree for an assignment. I've got the tiny subtree saying there are no more statements. And finally, I hit the right brace and I say, wait a minute. I hit the right brace. That's an entire program. I want to build a root node, the CSX light node, and I go ahead and do it. So in this case, you have the CSX light node, and it has the statements and all the rest. And for as tiny a program as that, you get a fairly complex AST node. But the point is it shows all the structure in exactly the right place. And if I were to do type checking or code generation, I have the basis of good analysis. So the point here is that small programs can create big trees, but it's not hard for you because you build them bit by bit by bit. And the mere fact a tree gets big doesn't really matter. I can imagine having tens of thousands of nodes, but in modern computers, who cares? You've got megabytes or gigabytes of memory. So the actual data doesn't matter. The fact that it's organized precisely, so I know exactly what's in the program. It's some statements. The first one is an assignment. The second one is no more. And here's the left-hand side, and there's the right-hand side. And it's all in just the right place, just waiting for further analysis. So the beauty of this is you can build complex structures, but you never have to do complex analysis, or at least only in one spot. I had a couple of students who got ahead of the gang and found a spot where things get a little more complex. And we'll get to that probably when they're out of town or something, but we'll get to there. So let's take a halt there, and I actually wanted to show you a run on this and actually running this on Eclipse, just to let you see that. And I wanted to show you a couple of other little goodies we had added into the Eclipse version. So I raised the point size. Oh, yeah, that's easy enough to read, right? So good. So situation here. So what this is a project 3. And what I'm going to do is let's check this in. Okay, the first goodie is, I warned you about this, is that at this stage, you'll probably want to run a number of test programs. Many of you have noticed that going into Eclipse and editing the actual build file is tedious. And it's something that's really unnecessary these days because we have much better interfaces. So what's happened is I've actually given you this, and this is essentially a simple GUI. Actually, there's a more complex version also available. So what will happen is if you have this enabled, and you will, you can go ahead and either have the test data specified in the make file, the build file, or you can bring up this little window that says, please go ahead and give me the name of a program. So let's go ahead and do that. Oh, I lost it. Where did it go to? And maybe run down to. Oh, come on, guy. Let me try rerunning this. Way down in the bottom? Oh, right there. No, that's something else. Here. Oh, God, thank you. Some of these things are smarter than I am. So what happens here is that one of the things I wanted to warn you, if you look here, we have a number of test programs. Some are suffixed light. And yeah, that's almost readable. And some are suffixed .csx. That makes a difference. Right now I'm in light land, but eventually I'll go to full CSX, and I have some test programs there. So since we're doing light at this point, I should choose a program that has a light suffix, and there's test.light. And what's happened here is that it's taken the name of that program, in this case test.light, and it's gone ahead and parsed it, built the AST, which you couldn't see because that's all internal. And then it did this unparsing business where it walked the tree, and in each part where I have a particular kind of AST node, I print out, using actual print lines, the textual representation. So, for example, if I was in an if node right here, I print out the if with the expression and then the body. And I'm doing pretty pretty line breaking and inserting and all that. So the important point here is that I have an unparser, and you'll get to that. But an unparser says for each AST node, let's look at the structure of the production that created it and undo it. And the way you undo it is by print out the equivalent. So that's what's happened there. And one of the things I wanted to show you is that in one of the programs we give you is called ARGS Processor. And this was donated by my co-author, Ron Citron, who did us great favor on this. And the GUI I just showed you is a simple one. By just changing this line, you might want to make a note. It's very near the top. And saving it and rebuilding. What it does is bring up a fancier sort of locator. This is the one where it shows you the file structure and you can go to subfiles, etc. So up here, you can see I have the various choices. I have test.light, and I have, yeah, I got bigger test.light, so I can select it. And if I wanted to go to folder, so if you have a variety of tests, you can wander around, pick the guy you want interactively. And in this case, this is a bigger test, and it just goes ahead and does whatever that test required. So the takeaway on this is that this already has the CSX Lite I showed you, and it's got this extra goodie built in that you get the choice of having a simple or more complex GUI. And what happens, let's go down to the build file, and I'll show you that. What happens is this thing is called, and I'm sure you can read that. Oh, yeah, it's not too bad. It's called test one. If I just go test, it won't bring up the GUI. It'll simply run the test files that are pre-wired into the build. So, you know, if you're just using the standard ones, why would you want to type in the names? You just go ahead and runs both of them, the test.light and the bigger test.light. But eventually you're going to want to, at some point, do more complex testing. So in that case, I'm just doing a clean. I always kind of do a clean to get the garbage out of the way so it does not get confused. And test one will bring up a GUI, either the simple one or the more complex one, depending on whether that flag is set to true or false. So I wanted to show you that because that's a handy thing to have and something you know about. And the rest of this is, you'll want to look at this is, It builds the scanner as you're accustomed to, and it builds the parser as you're accustomed to. So there's our DFA and all that, and then the parser. And if you have any errors on the parser, you'll get messages up here. But in this case, there were no errors, no warnings, so you're golden on that case. So I just wanted to show you a little bit about running this. But basically, you want to aim at the cup and the cup specification. And again, I think at this stage, you probably have enough information that you can actually go and start doing some simple extensions fairly soon. And the sooner the better, probably. So any questions on that about how do I do this or how do I do that or what if? I'm sure some issues will come up, but if you take CSX Lite and just add a few simple ones, that should go pretty cleanly. And then you can simply decide what order you want to add things. And again, at some point, you have to go from CSX Lite to full CSX. And that'll mean you'll have to do a little reorganization in terms of the test programs you use and the higher level structure. You have a different root node, and you'll have these methods containing statements in between, whereas currently statements are immediately the child of the root node. So what I want to do now is I've been talking about grammars and parsing, and I've been talking about almost like magic. And at some stage, we could actually stop at this stage and simply say, parsers work, use them, and just that's that. But I think we're all at the stage now where we like to think of ourselves as engineers or scientists. And if we can understand how something works, we can use it better and kind of narrow the gap between the people who design these systems and the people like us who use them. Turns out parsing looks pretty magic, but it's not that difficult, and particularly the simpler form. The person was asking earlier about LL as a simple kind of parser. And I'll actually start that today, and we'll get into the theory of it next time. But let me emphasize, at this stage, you can actually start building the assignment. That's what I wanted to get. That's why I talked about the cup stuff so early. And now what we're going to talk about is grammars and parsing and how it all actually works behind the scenes. So you're going to be writing down grammars, and grammars are like programs, at least in one way. Namely, you can make errors. And some errors are easy to detect, others are less easy. But I wanted to talk about a couple of errors that can appear. And you may actually encounter them. Simply, it's rather much like when you write a program. Sometimes you write an incomplete program, and you don't have enough information to actually go and do the full execution. So a grammar can have certain flaws that are easily distinguishable. They shouldn't be made, but they sometimes are. And these are what they call useless non-terminals. And a useless non-terminal, as the name suggests, is something that's in the grammar but doesn't serve a useful purpose. It's probably because the grammar is incomplete or maybe mistyped. One of the things you do is, for example, when you're copying my productions from the assignment into your program, is want to make sure you don't mistype things. Sometimes easy to go from statement or statements, decal or decals, and so on. Now, depending on the kind of software you have, I think a lot of software now allows you to do cut and paste from Adobe PDF into some other environment, like an editor or maybe even into Eclipse. Has anybody done that? Does Eclipse allow you to do a cut and paste directly from a PDF? That way, you do less typing because you pretty much copy the productions as there is, change the arrow into a double colon and add a semicolon, and away you go. So I don't know if that works. It certainly works on some applications. So one of the things you may do is you don't necessarily have to retype the productions line after line. You may be able to just do a cut and paste and do selective editing. If that works, that's fine. If not, well, then you do have to do the typing. But at any rate, if you were sloppy about creating a grammar or copying it, you could have a couple of varieties of useless non-terminals. I just want to point those out as a possible error so you're not too surprised. One of them is the fact that it's unreachable. From the start symbol. And that sometimes happens when you It's sort of like writing a method and putting it in your program, but not having any calls of it. Now, in our particular case, what the analyzer would typically do is say, hey, this is unreachable, and throw it away, which is not all that dissimilar to what a compiler does if it sees a method body that nobody ever calls. It may compile it, but it doesn't have to. Nobody ever uses the method body. It doesn't have to be actually compiled. You can just think of it as sitting in there for future reference. So you can have an unreachable symbol that says, hey, here's a production, but there's no way to get to that non-terminal starting at the start symbol. And I'll have an example of that in a bit. Another one that's kind of reminiscent of something we do, I won't say all the time, but do more often than we would wish, and you can have something that amounts to a non-terminal that never terminates its generation. It's an exact analog of an infinite loop. So, for example, I might have something like A goes to AA. I could use this production, but I can't use it effectively because each time I rewrite A, I get a little a, which is okay, but I get big A back again, which is not okay. This oftentimes is a result of just failing to create an entire set of productions at once, because you probably wanted to have something like this, where that terminated execution. So if it's the case that I find a non-terminal that never generates just terminal symbols, that's erroneous. Because if I ever tried to generate or parse, it would never complete the process and therefore never be usable. So let's go ahead and look at this grammar and analyze this just visually, and then we'll talk about how you could determine that these things existed. So S goes to A, B, or X. What I'm going to do is follow the convention that capital letters are non-terminals, lowercase are terminals. You can also tell if something's terminal or non-terminal. Non-terminals always appear on the left-hand side of a production, and terminals only appear on the right-hand side. So I have cap B goes to little b, cap A goes to little a cap A, that's just what I was talking about a moment ago, and C goes to little d. And I just chose little d because little c looked too much like capital C. So I can analyze this and say, does this have problems? Well, it certainly has this problem with A goes to little a cap A. That's my infinite loop. That's a terminal symbol that does not generate any, a non-terminal does not generate any terminal string. If I look at C, I can also say, hey, wait a minute. Here's a C goes to D, but starting at S, there's no way to get to C. S generates A and B, that's fine, but A and B don't involve C. So this is like having a method that I never actually call. It's in there. It may get a warning message or an error message because there's no point to having it in there. It can never be used because all derivations and all parses start at the start symbol. So you say, well, how could I determine that those things exist? And it happens that there are simple little algorithms. These are algorithms that don't compute numbers or don't sort numbers or do list manipulation, but they actually analyze a grammar, giving it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, depending on whether it passes the test for erroneous or not. So in this particular case, I'd want to find out if it's a situation where one or more terminal strings from a non-terminal. So let's find a non-terminal that can generate terminal strings. Anything that doesn't is erroneous. So the way we do that is we'll use a marking algorithm. And that's why I put this on paper, because the marking algorithm, assuming I get it all to fit, yeah. Because the marking algorithm is an easy thing to do on paper. So it says, let's mark all terminal symbols. I'll mark them by putting a little hat on them. So the initialization phase, just mark all symbols that are terminal. And those are easy because I have a definition of them. And that says I'm going to repeat until I can't do any further marking. And it says if all the symbols on the right-hand side are marked, then I mark the left-hand side symbol. So it says, for example, here's little b. If little b is a terminal symbol, it automatically generates terminals, so cap b can also. And every place I mark a symbol, I include the mark. Here's a case where D is terminal, so I mark C. And at this stage, if I have the entire right-hand side marked, I'll mark the left-hand side. But notice, here's a case where the A production does not generate a terminal string. And moreover, notice S, because it involves an A, does not generate a terminal string. So saying S is pretty useless. If I ever use this grammar as it is, I'd generate an A, but then A would never disappear. So it's like an infinite loop where the program never terminates. So that's one analysis I can do. And again, it's a very simple analysis. It says figure out the facts for single production or single non-terminal and extend it to additional non-terminals. I can do a second marking algorithm. In this case, I'll use hats to decide which symbols can be reached from the star symbol. So let's go ahead and write another copy. And this algorithm says I mark the starred symbol because I know that's where all derivations begin. So in this case, I'll put a little hat instead of a bar over him. And I go to the repeat loop and says, if the left-hand side of a production is marked, meaning I know it's reachable from the starred symbol, then I'll mark all the non-terminals on the left-hand side. So S is marked, so I say, hey, A and B are marked. And mark it there too. And as long as the left-hand side is marked, I mark the right-hand side and keep doing it until no more symbols can be marked. Well, notice C is not marked. So that says starting at S, there's no way I could ever reach C. So it's just like analyzing a call chain saying main calls this guy, calls that guy, calls that guy. But hey, this particular method can never be reached. In this case, that production can never be reached. So it's marked as being unreachable and therefore not usable. So those are two fairly simple ones. Here's one that's a little trickier and one that we really will need. Oops, what's this guy doing? Okay, it's still live. So I mentioned lambdas as being problematic in grammars. And in fact, some of the very earliest grammars, that doesn't look right, does it? I guess. That's darker than it usually is, isn't it? Well, I don't know. Okay, well, whatever. You have to read it. I can read the original. So it turns out that lambdas are difficult because when you're parsing, lambda is nothing. And normally the way a parser works, it says, I saw this symbol or I saw that symbol, and I'm going to go ahead and use a production corresponding to those symbols. But lambda is the invisible symbol. It's trivial to match. And therefore, you have the tendency to say, if I ever could drive lambda, figuring out whether I use lambda or not is going to be an issue. And in fact, it is, and we'll have to do some detail on that. So we'd want to know in advance when we have a grammar, is it the case that this non-terminal or the next can generate lambda? Because those are the potential bad boys. And we're going to say, okay, if you can generate lambda, I'm going to have to do a special analysis because you may be invisible and I still have to match you. And that could be difficult. So here's an algorithm that actually are used in grammar analyzers to say, of all the non-terminals I see, which one can generate lambda? And the basic idea is, if I have a direct derivation, then I go ahead and mark that symbol as driving lambda. And if the entire right-hand side of a production is all marked, which means they're all non-terminals, then it's the case the left-hand side will be marked, and I continue that until everything that's possible is marked. So now I knew there was going to be an A in there. There always is. So we're going to say, of these non-terminals, which ones are problematic when I get around to parsing because they may generate lambda? Anything that can generate lambda directly is problematic. So I'll circle C as problematic and D. But notice if the entire right-hand side is marked, in this case circled, that means the entire right-hand side can disappear in stages. I can say, give me a C, choose lambda. Give me a D, choose lambda. So B is problematic, and I mark that there. But notice that in this particular case, S is not problematic in that I know it's got to generate an A, cap A, and that has to generate a little a. So I have an analysis based on that algorithm that essentially tells me what particular productions can generate lambda. And I'm just talking about that now because I've been talking about analysis algorithms. And I think this is one. So I think this is a good spot to take a break. I think we're just at the half hour mark. Yeah. So this is a good spot to break, and we'll pick it up next week and talk a little bit more about how parsers actually operate. And we'll get into more detail in that. And again, if you have any issues on Project 1, email the TA and we'll get them resolved. And if he can't resolve it, I will. If you came in late and missed a grading sheet, I've got them up here for some people who missed. If you're a colleague or a good buddy of somebody and want to grab it for them on the honor system, you're welcome to do that too. Otherwise, I'll just bring it back next time.